I wanted people to see just the incredible worth in the Lamellarian's way of life. I really hoped to draw some attention to the issue of cultural extinction and to really just point out how the nature of humanity is changing in the modern world. And what I really admired about the Lamellarians was that despite all of the challenges arrayed against them, they were still making the choices as a community about what they were going to allow into the community and what they were going to keep from the old ways.
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles into the heart of adventure. This is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
What is lost when a whole culture disappears? Award-winning journalist Doug Bock-Clark has written an epic book about the Lamellarians, a tribe that lives on a remote eastern Indonesian island. For half a millennium, they have fed themselves by hunting sperm whales, using small, handmade boats and handmade harpoons. Until this day, this is the way they hunt and live. But how much longer? How does an endangered tribe face the challenge to navigate between ancient traditions and modern civilization? This is the story of Doug Bock-Clark's best-selling book, The Last Whalers, and it is what this interview is about. Please enjoy. Hi, Doug. Welcome to Unfolding Maps. I'm very pleased to have you on the show. Thanks for making the time.
Well, thanks for having me. It's an honor.
We are connecting today to talk about your amazing book, The Last Whalers. And in it, you describe an island called Lembata. Would you start by introducing us to this island? Where is it?
So Lembata is in the far east of Indonesia, far out into the Pacific Ocean. Sort of north of Australia and, you know, far to the east of mainland Asia. And it's a very small island. And one of the reasons that it's known is that on it lives a tribe called the Lamellarians, who are about 1,500 people. And they're an indigenous group that hunts sperm whales for their living using their old traditional methods. So they row out in these 35-foot wooden boats. And then they take down the sperm whales with bamboo harpoons, the same way that their ancestors have always done.
You indicated that this island is pretty remote. How ended the Lamellarians up on that island?
So the Lamellarians have been there for about 500 years. They originally lived on an island that was fairly close by, but a tsunami wiped it out. And so they took that as a sign that their ancestors, the spirits that they worship, wanted them to find a new home. So they went on an odyssey of sorts, and they sort of sailed around the archipelago. And when they finally reached Lamellara, after several adventures, they believed that the spirits wanted them to stay there, and they settled and soon began hunting whales, and they've never stopped.
And so hunting whales became a very essential part of their culture, an essential part of their personality as a tribe, of their traditions. What else is to be said about the way they have been living traditionally?
Well, so one of the most remarkable things about the Lamellarians is not just that they continue these ancient ways of hunting, but they've managed to preserve much of their culture that's not just the hunting, the same as it's always been. So they continue to have a very unique religion, which is partially Catholic, but also partially based on the worship of their ancestral spirits and the worship of the whales themselves. And they have a special group of shamans who've sort of hidden from the Catholic Church and hidden these basically stone altars that they believe have a special connection to their ancestors. And every year, they do special rituals there, and they maintain a spiritual connection to their past.
So they are still pretty much rooted in their traditions. And I know from many other countries, such as Laos, Cambodia, but also in Africa, that especially in the past 20 or 30 years, indigenous people have been pressured by the free flow of information, goods and technology and tourism and so on and so on. How have these developments transformed the Lamellarians so far?
So the Lamellarians have been subjected to a lot of those same forces of globalization that you mentioned. They are by no means ignorant of the rest of the world. They are very aware of what's going on, and a lot of the same market forces and industrialization and environmental change have reached them. But they, as a group, have made a very conscious effort to try to choose what is good about the old ways and preserve that, while also accepting some of the things that they like from modernity. And so I think one of the most unique and striking things about them is their attempts to sort of balance both keeping what's good in the old ways while also finding what's good in the new.
In this regard, you write pretty early on in the book the following sentence, quote, "Unless the Lamellarans can figure out how to navigate these proliferating troubles while remaining true to their identities, they confront their end." So that already indicates that navigating between the old and the new is indeed a pretty big challenge for them.
Absolutely. I think it's a challenge for them, but I also think it's a challenge for all of us. You know, once we were all hunter-gatherers, all humans survived by being hunter-gatherers. And a lot of our biological functions, a lot of sort of our ingrained cultural functions are all based on that. And now we're living in a world that doesn't line up with the way that we evolved. And so sort of having to choose between modernity and sort of the old ways is not an experience that's just unique to them. It's something that we're all going through.
And that have already happened on many other continents and many other places. You write on that topic, quote, "Though 5 centuries earlier, hunter-gatherers had occupied the entirety of Australia, most of North America, and much of South America, Africa, and Asia, by the dawn of the second millennium, they had been almost wiped out," end of quote. And you also mentioned that since about the 16th century, so about 500 years ago, roughly, there was an accelerating wave of cultural extinction that has halved the number of cultures worldwide, with thousands being lost in the last century alone. So this is a very striking development if you summarize us like that.
Indeed. I mean, you know, we often think about how climate change is changing the world, or how biological extinction is changing the world, and the, you know, countless species that are being wiped out from that. But we don't often think about the phenomenon of cultural extinction. As you noted, you know, not long ago, there were, you know, 15,000 cultures before, you know, separate, distinct cultures that anthropologists would sort of identify as having their own languages and culture and identity, before European colonialization. And then after that, as the world has sort of become much more similar, as industrialized ways of life have taken over, you know, almost all of those cultures are getting wiped out. And within 50 years, you know, we'll be down to a few hundred, which is a huge loss of, you know, human potential and history and identity that I don't think the world or humanity has really grappled with.
And in that sense, the story of the Lamellarans that you write about is actually really a story about the greater cultural extinction humanity is suffering, isn't it?
Absolutely. I personally have a lot of connections to the Lamellarans and a huge amount of love for them, but through telling their story, part of what I was hoping to focus on was to tell the story of humanity over the last few hundred years and how we have transitioned from these hunter-gatherer lifestyles to a much more monocultural industrial one.
Yeah, and you try to answer several kinds of questions in that context, such as what is being lost as our original modes of life die out? Who are we now? And what will we become? How and when have you yourself started to think about such questions?
I thought about them a lot while living with the Lamellarans. People often think of hunter-gatherers as being poorer or less technologically advanced. But anthropologists who've widely studied these groups and done a great deal of in-depth research often call these groups the original affluent society. And by that, they mean, well, okay, these groups might not have TVs, they might not be materially wealthy, but on the whole, many of them actually have a better average life by many metrics than a lot of Americans or Germans or others. They work less, on average about 20 hours a week. In some ways, they're healthier. They don't have the same high levels of it, diabetes and other diseases of sloth. And most importantly, on various types of surveys and so on and so forth, they report being much happier than we are, much less lonely. When you live in a hunter-gatherer group and, you really have to do everything by manpower and you have to coordinate to do it, you form very, very strong communal bonds. And so to get anything done, you have to work with other people. And there's no option to sort of go and get your own backhoe or, big power machine to do a task. You work with 20 other guys to, cut down these trees or build this boat. You can't just go out and buy one. And so that very strong communal sense of identity and way of life is actually how humans have lived for most of our evolutionary history. And the lack of it is, I think, one of the major roots of loneliness and isolation in modern society.
How and when did you become aware of the Lamalarans and their struggles for the first time?
So I became aware of the Lamalarans about 5 years before I wrote the book. I was living in Indonesia, in a fairly out of the way part, but not as far away as Lambata. And I heard about them and I didn't believe it at first. I had to go and sort of Google and, see some images and, be like, oh, this is real and it's still happening. And I was extremely curious about going and seeing it for myself. And so, during one of my breaks, I just sort of headed east along the archipelago. I'd take a public bus to the ferry terminal at the end of each island, get on the ferry terminal, get on the next bus. And, as you go island to island to island, you get further and further out. And it's almost like passing 100 years or 50 years for each island you hop as you go east. And then the last step to get to Lamalera, I got to this small island named Lambata, and then I went to the bus terminal. And at that point, they were using basically what were converted dump trucks to go up and over a mountain range and a big volcano to then descend to the other side and get to Lamalera. And as soon as you step off the dump truck, which you sort of ride in the bed, you can see the beach, and the beach is covered with all the whaling boats and with the big whale bones, and you immediately know you're in a place that's like nowhere else in the rest of the world.
How did you start to explore this place? Did you walk up and down the beach once and that's it for the first trip? Or how did you start to explore this place and get a feel of it?
Well, so Lamalera is physically not a very big place. It's mostly a beach and then a community of about 1,500 people who live around that beach in a fairly small, maybe 2 or 3 square miles of land. And so there's not a lot to sort of physically walk around and see. You could see it all in an hour or two. But what I did and what I feel so incredibly grateful to the Lamalarans for was I just sort of started talking to everyone. I had lived in Indonesia for some time. I spoke Bahasa fluently, Bahasa being the national language. And I don't think a lot of outsiders who go there can speak Bahasa very well. And so everyone, once they realized I could speak Bahasa, just wanted to talk. And so I just spent hours and hours sitting on the beach and chatting with everyone. And then at that point, I wasn't a writer. I didn't particularly have any plans to write about the Lamalarans or anything. I was basically just exploring. And so I spent several weeks there and I got to know several of the people whom I would later write about. But at that point, I had no aim to write anything about them at all. They just really affected me and they just really stuck in my memory. And so after I left, and did eventually become a professional writer, I always knew I wanted to go back. And when I had sort of the capacity to start doing longer projects and more in-depth projects, one of the first things I did was go back to Lamalera.
You said this place and its people affected you and intrigued you. What was it about them that affected you so much that it pulled you back all these years later?
A lot of it was just purely the friendship. I probably spent, I don't know, maybe a little less than a month or 3 weeks there the first time. You know, and I just, you know, I just spent that time going out hunting with them and joining the ceremonies and just hanging out. And there was one family called the Blikololongs, who really were just incredibly generous and who I felt a strong connection to. And, you know, others as well. You know, so I think the first and most important connection was just on a human level. But while I was there, you know, I could also see very much that this was an incredibly unique culture that had managed to do something extraordinary, which is preserve itself in a time of great change and great upheaval. I had traveled to many parts of the world before this, especially sort of the fringes of the developed world where, you know, indigenous groups were coming into contact with industrialized civilizations for the first time. And historically, what you see when that happens is the indigenous group becoming overwhelmed fairly quickly. But the Lamalarians, you know, had been in contact with the outside world for decades and had just consciously chosen to maintain this older way of life, even as other whaling communities around them had given up and, you know, become industrialized fishermen or, you know, petrol bomb fishermen. Were just sort of moved and gotten jobs in the city. And they saw a great deal of worth to maintaining the ways of the ancestors. And I was very struck by this choice and thought, well, they're actually like, why are they doing this? And then, you know, I thought I could see at the beginning that, you know, maybe there was a great deal of worth to the decision they were making.
Do you remember the first whale hunt you were able to join?
I do. And it was the first of many whale hunts that I threw up on. The Lamalarians thought it was hilarious because they are very good seamen. And at that point, I was not didn't have my sea legs under me. And whenever the waves still get too big, I'll usually end up throwing up, which they love to joke about. They call it baiting the fishes. And now they ask me to bait the fishes because they like to joke that if I throw up, the whales will come.
How was that experience for you besides the throwing up for the very first time?
Well, the whale, yeah. You know, in general, the whale hunts are spectacular and harrowing and unforgettable experiences. They're physically taxing, they're emotionally taxing, but they're like, you know, I think few other events in the world. What will happen is, you know, so the Lamalarian village is set on a number of cliffs on the edge of the sea, and the village overlooks a very special deep water strait, and that strait channels migrations of whales and other marine mammals. And so when the Lamalarians see the whales coming through this strait, they will yell out "Baleo, Baleo," which means basically the whales are here, let's go hunt. And the fleet will launch, which is 14 boats. And when the boats get close enough to the whales to strike, a man will run down a bamboo platform that sticks off the front of the boat and leap into the air and use his body weight to push a 16-foot bamboo harpoon into the whale. And at the tip of that harpoon is a metal harpoon head to which a rope is tied, and that rope links the harpoon head to the whale once it's embedded. And by no means is that first strike the end of the hunt. That's just the very first beginning part of the battle. Once a boat is attached, the whale obviously did not like being stabbed. It will probably fight back. Whales, sperm whales can be, you know, 65, 70 feet long, weigh 60 tons or more. They're much bigger than the boats, often twice as big, and they will try to destroy the boats.
What kind of boat is it usually?
So these boats are called Taina. The Lamalarians use several types of boats, but there's only one kind of boat that's allowed to be used in the whale hunt, which is called the Taina, and it's an ancient boat, which they don't, they have not allowed to have any changes be made in it. And it's about 35 feet long. It's constructed according to the ancient ways without any nails or screws or other modern artifacts. And they are designed to basically be floating tanks. They're not very hydrodynamic. They're not super quick, but they can withstand, you know, most damage. And so when the whale attacks it, the men will sort of dive down underneath these protective coverings and wait for the whale to exhaust itself, while other boats, which the whale is not paying attention to, will then try and harpoon it as well. And so over the course of many hours, the whale might have, you know, 5 or 6, or even in exceptional cases, you know, a dozen boats attached to it, in which case it soon becomes exhausted and it starts to bleed out and become weak. And, you know, it's really a war of attrition. It's death by 1,000 pinpricks. And the Lamellarans, you know, just sort of keep stabbing it and, you know, all start to aim for particular points. But the blubber is too thick for them to really ever deal a death blow. You know, it can be a foot thick or more. So they, you know, pretty much just have to open up a whole lot of cuts for it to slowly bleed out, all the while it's fighting back.
That sounds like a pretty brutal and bloody process. How was it for you for the very first time to witness that?
You know, it is a harrowing experience. It is, it's not something to be done lightly. You know, tourists do go to La Molera trying to see a hunt. And I think that sometimes when they get to see it, they're often get more than they bargained for. At the same time, while any sort of hunting experience is a life or death experience, it's also a spiritual experience for the La Molerans. They believe that the whales are gifts sent to them by their ancestors in return for following the ancient ways. And so when they get a whale, it's basically a karmic sign that they're doing everything right, and that it's a spiritual affirmation that they're living in the right ways. And so while it's incredibly sad that a very intelligent mammal dies during this process, for the La Molerans, it's not a needless slaughter. They're doing it to feed themselves. They get most of their calories from the hunt. And they're also doing it for their own spiritual practices.
If the hunt is successful, what do they do with this giant catch?
So if they finally do manage to subdue the whale, then they will tow it back to shore. And usually the next day, the whole community will gather to butcher it. You know, a whale will often be between 30 to 60 tons of meat. That's enough to feed, you know, the whole tribe for an extended period of time. So what they do is they cut it up into small pieces and they then dry those pieces. And while the ship that captured the whale first is known as the group that, you know, killed it and sort of gets the biggest portion, the tribe always makes sure to share out the whale meat so that basically everyone gets some. They have a very special and specialized set of cultural practices around this, but it's for this reason that anthropologists think of them as one of the more generous groups in the world. You know, anthropologists have gone and lived with various groups all over the world and sort of rated how well they share resources. And so a La Molaran is actually more likely to give away more of a resource to someone else than to keep it for his or herself. And a lot of that comes from the fact that they're sort of constantly sharing out the whales. You know, if you catch a whale, it's too big for you or even your clan and all your buddies to eat by yourself. You know, who you and your, you know, best, you know, your family and all of your relatives still can't eat 30 tons of meat. And so, you know, they've adapted to make sure that everyone gets a share, and it's an extremely communal situation.
How can I imagine this communal situation? Are there specific practices, specific songs that are being sung, or special dances, or how does this process work?
No, it's much more everyday than that. You know, it's mostly butchering work. You know, people have to cut it up, and it's actually really, really hard to cut up that much meat. You know, hundreds of people will be working to divide up, you know, just to physically break down the carcass. And then, you know, it's just the men will sit in a circle and they'll sort of go around, and someone in the middle will just sort of give everyone a piece. And then the next guy will do it, and they'll give everyone a piece. And then from there, each man will sort of take his pile and redistribute it among his friends and his family. So there's no big fanfare. It's just sort of, you know, no dances or songs. It's just baked into life. It's just part of life.
In the chapter Lamellaran Odyssey, you write about a whale hunt gone wrong. Would you tell that story?
So in one of the chapters that you mention, I tell the story of a hunt that happened in 1994 and which has become something of a legend among the Lamellarans. And in it, a large portion of the fleet attacked a large whale. And this was before the time when they had motorboats or that there was much modernity at all in that part of the archipelago. And so they sailed out using their palm leaf sails and rowed after the whale. And they got very far from shore. And then once they stabbed the whale did not give up and didn't seem to get tired, didn't seem to be particularly hurt by the harpoons. And so the boats were now attached to the whale by the harpoon ropes. And the whale decided to swim away and swim even deeper into the ocean. And it dragged them overnight into the middle of the Savu Sea. And the next morning, the Lamellarans realized how far away they were from shore, and they realized they had very little supplies with which to survive. And so they had to make a really hard decision. Do we still want to try and kill this whale, or should we, you know, just cut our ropes and go home? And the Lamellarans actually decided, all right, you know, we do this for a living. You know, we're very capable warriors. We're going to try one more time to kill this whale. But during that fight, the whale destroyed a large portion of the fleet. So when the men finally did give up and cut their harpoon ropes and let the whale swim away, they only had, I believe, 3 boats left. And there were more men who were sort of crammed onto them than they could fit. And even worse, they were now very far from shore. They hadn't been provisioned for an overnight hunt. They were running out of food and water. And as they tried to row and sail back to shore, they were hit by a number of storms. And so over the next several days, they kept trying to get to shore, but were increasingly weaker and weaker until they thought they were actually going to die. And at the very last minute, a cruise ship, of all things, happened to cross their path, see them, and understand what was happening, that these were, you know, men adrift at sea, and rescue them, which was a highly improbable event, but a collision between modernity and the ancient world that made a great impression on a lot of these whalers, many of whom had never been aboard a modern ship before. And the cruise ship ended up bringing them to, you know, the capital port city of the province, when many of them got to see, you know, TVs and radios and many of these other things, which were very rare for them to see. And so that moment really marked a transition point for the tribe, in that, you know, a large part of the fleet was destroyed, though it was eventually rebuilt, and that many of these men were forced to reckon with their own mortality and also with the transforming world.
And one of these men was Franz, and about him and his experience of seeing this first glimpse of modern civilization, you write, quote, "When Franz stared at the western horizon, he remembered the alien world beyond it, and he could only wonder when it would arrive," unquote. I believe this quote is probably taken from the moment when he has returned to his island. Which impact has had seeing this whole new world on him personally, that he was part of this whale hunt?
So Franz is a very good friend and a really important person in the tribe. At the time, he was a young captain and also a shaman. And I think that that experience had a very important impact on him, sort of showing him what was out there in the wider world and, you know, that it was probably going to come. And so over the years since, he's become a very important mediating influence between sort of the old guard who wants nothing to change and the new guard who really wants things to move very quickly. And so he wants to preserve the traditions, but also realizes that the world is changing. And so much of his story in the book is trying to figure out how to navigate those complications.
Does he have a specific philosophy or approach to navigating these difficulties?
No, Franz was an incredibly wise and is an incredibly good man. You know, on the one hand, he'll consult with the ancestors, and he's also a deeply Christian, so he'll sort of look for spiritual guidance. But on the other hand, he just tries to be humane and listens to, you know, what everyone is telling him. As the head of one of the Lamellarian clans, you know, he has to sort of be concerned with everyone's viewpoint. And so I've seen him in many situations act as a key mediator between everyone.
Another memorable person from the book is John. Who is he?
So John is a young harpooner. And when I first arrived back at the island in 2014, not long after I got there, he was involved in a very serious whaling accident in which his leg was almost crushed. And it was unclear whether or not he would ever be able to walk again, let alone hunt again. But as an orphan, it was his responsibility to care for his orphan siblings, his two sisters, as well as his elderly grandparents. And he really, really wants to become a harpooner. That's sort of the highest, most honorable position in the clan. And so over the next 3 years and throughout the book, I sort of followed him as he attempted to regain his health and his strength and become a harpooner.
What do you need to do to become a harpooner?
So to become a harpooner, you really need to both master the physical craft. You know, it's an incredibly hard athletic experience, you know, where you have to be able to spear all kinds of animals from the front of a moving ship. It's not an easy thing to do at all. You know, a whale is easy to hit, but a shark or a manta ray or a marlin are not. And you also have to master what the Lamellarians call the way of the Lamafa, which is a spiritual practice, sort of a balance, a karmic balance, and that the Lamafa is the leader of the ship. He's the harpooner. And for the ancestors to reward him with a good catch, he has to be spiritually in tune with their teachings. So not only is it a position of physical leadership on the boat, it's also the position of spiritual leadership. So for John to get the chance to become a Lamafa was really not only about learning how to spear things well, it was also learning about the moral and sort of religious and ethical considerations of being a man.
John faces quite a dilemma, as his people as a whole do, and you have written a very powerful section in the book on that. Would you mind reading a small section from the book for us?
Of course. What pages would you like?
It is on page 54 up to page 55 till the end of the second paragraph, if that would be fine with you.
John stayed in Loang 6 months. Having seen Lewaleba, he fantasized about joining the small community of Lamellarians living in the futurescape of Jakarta. But he worried about who would take care of his grandparents and sisters, as well as about disappointing the ancestors and being taken advantage of by notoriously sly city dwellers. And the old dream of becoming a Lamafa still pinched his heart. Most of the Earth's indigenous people, more than a third of a billion in all, face the same quandary as John. Adopt an industrialized lifestyle or remain loyal to their traditions and be disadvantaged in the contemporary world. Globalization has brought undeniable improvements in health, education, and wealth to certain swaths of the human population. But by joining the modern world, Aboriginal people often trade livelihoods that are harmonized to their ecosystems for ones that destroy it. Bespoke mythologies for impersonal Hollywood or Bollywood or Nollywood legends, and a tight-knit tribal identity for an indifferent national one, which usually aims to subordinate their tribal bonds so that they will melt into the wider population. This challenging choice is a daily struggle for John and his fellow Lamellarians. Labor as a whaler or a construction worker. Participate in a barter or a cash economy. believe in the stories of the ancestors or the ones being told on TV. The sum of their decisions and those of other indigenous people will ultimately determine if humanity can sustain its myriad identities, or if, in the end, these ways of being human will be extinguished and we will become a homogenized mass, with all cultures diluted into an industrial monoculture.
How did John think about all of that, about these questions?
You know, I think John thought about them much more on a personal level than on a level of the future of the tribe or anything. You know, I think he was very much aware that, you know, the choice, his own choice and the choice of his, you know, peers was going to determine how successful the Lamellarians were at keeping their traditions. And he very much wanted the traditions to stay alive. They were incredibly important to him and they still are. But, you know, he also realized that he was living a very hard and dangerous lifestyle. And it was absolutely normal and logical for him to wonder if there was an easier, maybe more glamorous way to live.
How did he decide eventually? What kind of decision did he make for his future?
No, you'll have to read the book, right?
That's a fair answer. That's a fair answer.
I'll joke about it. I joke about it. And I think your listener should read the book. But in some ways, he, you know, I'll give enough away that he achieves the rank of harpooner, but he also in time, you know, still remains interested in the modern world. And that's a tension that he has to navigate.
And it is a very, suspenseful, a very thrilling story that you tell about him. And as far as I know, originally, you intended to make him the sole protagonist of your book. Is that right?
You know, it was pretty clear very early on that he was going to be a major person. But in 2014, when I first went back and was sort of laying the groundwork for the book, I didn't know who I was going to write about. I started following maybe about 10, a dozen people. And, you know, when I start a documentary project like this, the goal is to let the story happen, to not force anything onto the story. So it became clear very quickly that John would be a central character. But, you know, there are three families that all sort of get equal screen time with John. And it wasn't clear exactly who those people were going to be for at least a year.
But it became clear that the hero wasn't John primarily, but it was the tribe itself.
Absolutely. The goal was to write about, it's impossible to write about all 1,500 Lamellarians, but to sort of try and capture the experience of the tribe by choosing a cross-section of people. You know, both sort of the classic young harpooner like John, but also an older shaman and other people in different places and positions in the tribe to give their perspectives as well.
You have mentioned the shamans quite a few times. What role do they play in today's society on the island?
So they act as, you know, spiritual leaders and mediators between the ancestors and the Lamellarians. They lead some of the ancient rituals, but they also play an everyday role in the Lamellarians believe that nothing happens from chance. You know, everything that happens happens because of how the ancestors or God determines it. And so if things are going badly, one thing that the Lamellarians will often do is to ask a shaman to intercede for them and to help them figure out how they angered the ancestors and what sort of ritual they might do to fix it.
Which kind of ancient rituals are we talking about? Would you be able to give an example?
So they can be all sorts of things. You know, they can be various forms of prayer, or it could be trying to wipe away a curse by pouring holy water on a person, or it could be sacrificing animals in order to sort of basically feed the whale's spirits and call them back if it's the whales have not been there for a long time.
What were your biggest challenges during the work on this book?
You know, I think trying to balance, you know, being an impartial journalist with also being very close to the community and really caring a lot about many of the people there was a lot. There's a lot of, you know, things that you had to be careful of as a journalist in doing that. And the physically being there could be hard. You know, I was out, I tried to do everything the Lamellarians did. I tried to immerse myself in their life as much as possible. you know, I'm a young guy in decent shape, but they're in better shape than me. So there's many times not only would I be throwing up at sea, but just physically worn out. And being away from America for very long stretches of time, where my wife was very patiently letting me pursue a project that she knew meant a lot to me, and where other professional obligations and personal obligations took a pause as I lived for months at a time with this hunter-gatherer tribe with very few connections to the outside world. And I feel extraordinarily lucky and grateful for the grace that a lot of people gave me to allow me to do this.
I believe things haven't been made easier due to the fact that the Lamellarans don't have a written history.
No, they mostly just have an oral history, though it's increasingly being written down now as more of them get interested in doing so. But they have incredibly rich oral history, and people were always very generous and willing to tell me the stories and go into detail with me on them.
How did that happen, this going into detail? How did you conduct the interviews?
Well, one of my favorite parts about interviewing in La Molera was I would often do it on the beach, which is where all the men hang out in their downtime, and it would become sort of a community event. People would see I was talking to someone about something that happened in the past or the story, and, all the elders would sort of come down and sort of, pull up a jug of palm wine and we'd talk it through. And that was, I found, incredibly useful. Because rather than the story sort of relying on one person's memory from, an event 50 years ago, all of a sudden you had a dozen people and they would sort of talk among each other and correct. And, you could see them working to get it more exact and they would. Though, of course, I also conducted a whole lot of interviews, especially about more personal subjects, sort of in privacy with the people.
And then began probably huge amount of work to sort through all of these recordings and put that into some kind of structure that makes sense and really tells a story.
Yeah. So I would, so I spent about a year with the Lamellarans, but that year was broken up into 3-4 month chunks across 3 years. And so I would usually go and report over the course of a hunting season for about 4 months. And then I would come back and I had other obligations as a journalist. And they let me go away on book leave for 4 months or so. But then I would come back and do my normal job. And during that time, I would be staying in touch with the Lamellarans as much as possible and also working on the book to sort of shape it, to sort of go through the notes, to figure out what I'd experienced before, and that informed the reporting for the next year. And so the project all told took almost 4 years. And, it was maybe 500,000 words worth of notes, I think about 20,000 photographs, hours and hours of video. And by the end, I had this incredibly rich archive of work and of records from which to draw. And I was also very lucky in that former anthropologists who'd been there eventually ended up granting me their access to their records as well. And so by the end, I had just this incredibly rich trove of information with which to weave a story that, hopefully would incorporate decades of life in the tribe.
So a lot of work. What was your motivation, your driving force during the execution of this project? Did you have any particular hope for its impact?
I just wanted to make sure that the story was told right, which I know sounds almost naive, but I don't think you can get through a project as complex and as long and as crazy as The Last Whalers without just really believing in it as the core. I wanted people to see just the incredible worth in the Lamellarans' way of life. I really hoped to draw some attention to the issue of cultural extinction and to really just point out how the nature of humanity is changing in the modern world. But in some ways, that the results of a project are out of my control. I can do the project itself as well as I possibly can, and I always try to. But, as a journalist, I do a lot of projects, and you quickly learn that the only thing you can control is how good the project itself is, and what the world does with it afterwards is beyond you.
in terms of cultural extinction and putting a spotlight on that issue. How do you respond to the argument that, well, languages and cultures have always risen and vanished throughout time, and maybe it's a bit more now, but that's just the way things progress. That's just the price of development that we have to pay as humankind or humanity.
Well, what I always try to emphasize is that it should be the indigenous group's choice about whether or not to adopt modern ways and to give up their old culture. It is true that cultures have always been evolving, that languages are always changing as are cultures. But what we're seeing right now is that happening under unprecedented pressure and unprecedented speed. And so groups that, you know, might once have made such choices over a generation or two are not getting that choice. you know, a factory comes in, cuts down their forest and plants coffee trees. And all of a sudden they become basically the slave labor on a plantation. Or, you know, a government will come in and force their kids into schools which ban the teaching of their language and which force them to adopt certain practices while forgetting their old ways, which are not a, which, you know, many, many studies have shown is not conducive for anyone's health or for anyone's human rights.
Is that still happening? I mean, I know these kind of stories from Native American reservations from the 50s and 60s or even 20s of the 20th century. Is that still being practiced in Indonesia, for example?
In Indonesia, well, debatably. I'm not going to get into Indonesian politics, but there are certain groups such as the Orang Rimba in Sumatra where other people would say that's very much happening. Especially as the Muslim majority forces sort of these animist tribes to come out of the jungle and to go to certain schools. I have not personally seen it and can't vouch for it beyond, you know, the reports in places like BBC and so on and so forth. But on the whole, this is something that's happening. You know, in India, you know, there's many India, the Amazon, wherever these groups are left, they're often sitting on some of the last sort of valuable and untapped environmental troves that continue to exist. And even for the groups that are not actively being destroyed, they're basically being run over. They don't, you know, they're some of the world's most vulnerable people. They don't have a lot of resources. And what I really admired about the Lamellarians was that despite all of the challenges arrayed against them, they were still making the choices as a community about what they were going to allow into the community and what they were going to keep from the old ways. So every year, all the men get together at a ceremony called Tobu Namafata, which is the council on the beach. And all of the men decide the rules for the tribe for that year. So this year, you're going to be allowed to use a cell phone, or this year, you're going to be allowed to, you know, use an outboard motor in this way, but we're going to keep the rules in a very specific way so you don't violate some of these older ancient rules. And so the community literally sort of figures out what is good about the outside world and what they want to allow, and also decides about what they think is more important about their ancient ways and what they want to keep. And I think the consciousness, the intentional decision making behind a process like the Tobu Namafata is the essential key to a humane and ethical form of modernization. These groups should be allowed to make their own choices about how they want to engage with the modern world.
Up till today, Indonesia has not signed the International Convention for the Regulation of Whaling. How do you think about that?
So that's a very complicated situation, and goes into a lot of part of things of national sovereignty and politics that are above my head.
But even if they would have signed it, the convention allows for Aboriginal subsistence hunts anyway, like the Lamellarians, right?
Yeah. So the reason there are sort of complicated reasons why they may not have signed, in that Japan asks various countries not to sign it so that Japan has a stronger chance of whaling and other sort of complicated things around it. But whether or not Indonesia ever signs the International Convention on the Regulation of Whaling it would not affect the Lamellarans. The Lamellarans are subsistence hunters. They don't hunt for profit or to sort of sell the meat or anything else. They take about 20 sperm whales a year. Sperm whales are not an endangered species. There are several hundred thousand left in the world. And under the convention's clauses guarding subsistence whaling, they would be allowed to continue their hunt because it's primarily for food and for cultural reasons.
Do you dare to predict what the future of the Lamellarans will be like?
Man, with COVID and everything else happening, I feel like I can't predict what will happen a month from now. But I think in general, you know, I really hope that the Lamellarans continue to practice sort of this conscious engagement with the outside world. They've managed to keep what they think is worthwhile about their culture, and I really hope that they'll continue to do so in the future.
Is there anything you would say you have learned from the time that you have spent with them? I mean, you have learned a lot. You wrote a whole book about what you've learned about them, but did you learn something that was very impactful for yourself and potentially for your own life back home?
Just, whenever I think about La Malaria, I just think about the incredible generosity of the people who let me share their lives for a few years. And, you know, I think in their courage in, you know, facing a world that didn't always fully make sense to them, but they were still generous enough to welcome in strangers and to look at it with wonder while also realizing that their own ways were just worth keeping.
Yeah, and that they are worth keeping is shown very impactfully in your book that we have talked about today, The Last Whalers, The Life of an Endangered Tribe in a Land Left Behind by you, Doug Bock Clark. It is really a great book, and I highly recommend it. It's one of the most thrilling and gripping, interesting, and in-depth books in terms of nonfiction that I've read in the past few years. And I really also congratulate you to that work. I can only guess how much work it was. I mean, you gave us a feeling it was a lot of time spent on the desk in research, but also out there hunting, living with them, working with them, and having the patience and the curiosity to really try to understand a people, a tribe. And yeah, I congratulate you for the result. And I thank you so much that you took the time to talk it through with me.
Well, it's been a real pleasure. And I really appreciate the kind words.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot, Doug Bock Clark, for this fascinating conversation. And thanks to all of you listeners. I hope you liked this conversation. If you did, please consider helping us out and leaving a review in the Apple Podcast app for our show to support us getting the word out. It would really mean a lot to me. You can also support the show by becoming a supporter. Information about this can be found on our website unfoldingmaps.com or on our Patreon page. Thanks and bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.